Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The G20 meeting doesn't officially start for another day yet, but it's already clear how things are going to go. President Obama is going to pay a steep price for the Fed's $600 billion spending spree. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. And by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at AllyBank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 10th of November today, which means it's already Thursday morning over in South Korea, so I suppose you could say the G20 summit actually starts today. But whatever the semantics, President Obama is going to walk in the door a bit on the defensive. In a letter to other leaders last night, the president said, in essence, hey, we all need to get along if we want to get the global economy growing again. The letter followed sharp criticism of the U.S. the past couple of days from pretty much everybody out there. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports now on the $600 billion trickle-down effect.
The reason Germany, China, and many emerging economies have an axe to grind with the U.S. right now boils down to one thing. Andrew Rose is a professor of international business at Berkeley.
The reason why the Europeans especially, but also the Asians, are upset is because the Fed has decided to engage in quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing is the unusual monetary policy the Federal Reserve announced last week. It's aimed at lowering interest rates to encourage borrowing and lending. It does that by printing a lot of money, $600 billion worth. Rose says that pushes the value of the dollar down, and that makes our trading partners feel threatened.
Primarily, they're worried about their export competitiveness. When the American dollar depreciates, that gives us a cost advantage. So as we gain, they lose. And that's what they're worried about.
For developing countries like Brazil and Thailand, they worry that lower U.S. interest rates will send investors flooding into their markets looking for higher returns. That could spark inflation. Another concern is that the U.S.'s move could prompt other countries to throw up trade barriers, says Bill Frenzel with the Brookings Institution.
The other part is a fear of international protectionism. This looks to the world like the opening salvo in an international protectionist trade war.
To calm those fears, the Obama administration is trying to convince the world that it's just doing what it has to restore health to the U.S. economy, and that it wants other countries' support in letting currencies readjust, says Charles Freeman with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If everybody says we're taking our marbles and going home, we've got kind of a mess. I think what the administration and the Fed is doing is saying we believe that what's really best for the world is if the U.S. economy genuinely recovers.
The recession has weakened the U.S., but it's still the world's largest economy. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Interestingly enough, even though we've been talking about quantitative easing like it's already happening, it's not. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York announced today that they're going to start buying up Treasury bonds on Friday. There's an interesting case of musical chairs being played out in New York City today. The city's schools chief, Joel Klein, is stepping down to go to work for the world's biggest media company, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, of course. Klein is going to be replaced by a media type, Kathleen Black, the head of Hearst Magazines and the former publisher of USA Today. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more.
News Corp declined to give details of Joel Klein's new job description, only that he'd be helping the media giant develop business strategies for the emerging educational marketplace. So what, a new chain of Rupert Murdoch charter schools? A person close to the company says no, Murdoch is not interested in managing school systems, but providing seed money for small startups. And media analyst Claire Enders speculates that may include online education products for the iPad and other internet tablets.
Textbooks, learning tools, testing tools, exam tools. Probably the single biggest growth area in education is completely digital.
So if a school leader like Joel Klein can help a media titan like Murdoch make money off education, what can a media exec like Kathleen Black bring to the New York schools? Media analyst Gary Arlen believes it's more than just budgeting skills and fundraising connections.
the public sector is recognizing the value of media as part of the culture and the way people learn, and bringing in people who understand how to communicate, especially to young students, is, I think, a very, very forward-looking idea.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg thinks so. He said Black's business savvy makes her the perfect schools leader. The mayor may need to persuade a few folks of that notion. The New York Daily News today described Black as a Park Avenue exec who sent her kids to a fancy boarding school. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today started low, ended high. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was more bad news today for one of the companies that makes engines for the world's biggest passenger plane. That would be the Airbus A380. Singapore Airlines pulled three of its A380s out of service today after it found some oil stains in the jetliner's Rolls-Royce engines. Qantas, you might remember, has grounded all six of its A380s after an engine blowout last week and some other oil leaks as well. Much as there are just two big commercial plane makers, Boeing and Airbus, there are just three main commercial jet engine makers. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explores now whether problems for Rolls-Royce could be a boon for its American competitors.
The trouble with Rolls-Royce engines may not show up in the official sales pitches of its top American rivals General Electric and Pratt & Whitney, but aviation industry consultant Michael Boyd says those companies will likely find a way to exploit Rolls' misfortunes as a reliability issue.
Unofficially in a back room over a cocktail, it'll certainly come up by the competition. Don't kid yourself.
This is just the latest in a series of problems involving jet engines made by Rolls-Royce, which is a separate business from the BMW-owned carmaker. It also had an engine blow up on a ground test for Boeing's 787 Dreamliner, which is still in development. And since GE also makes jets for that plane, its sales could see a boost. Industry consultant Scott Hamilton says airlines buying the 787 have a choice between Rolls or GE.
The sales to date are fairly evenly split between the two companies, but at least half of the customers have not yet selected the engine.
On the other hand, the Rolls-Royce engine problems could just end up being a minor bump on takeoff. Hamilton says the rush to develop a new generation of fuel-efficient jetliners has pushed technology to its edges.
Nobody can seem to put together a new program efficiently like they could in the good old days. You never saw this kind of stuff coming up.
At Jetstream Aviation Capital, industry analyst Stuart Klaskin says he's not surprised when problems like this do come up.
You have to take a step back and say, well, look what they're doing. You know, this is literally rocket science.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
If you're uncomfortable with the idea of being stuck 35,000 feet in the air inside a skinny aluminum tube with engines hanging off of it, you do have some choices. Cars, obviously. For longer distances, there are buses and trains. Amtrak's got it to sell a high-speed rail service in the Northeast Corridor. But if high-speed rail is going to happen on a bigger scale, it's going to be out here in California. Last year, voters approved a $10 billion bond measure to fund a train that can zip people from L.A. to San Francisco in just 2.5 hours. From KALW in San Francisco, Casey Miner wraps up our series on the future of transportation.
When Bob Doty stands in the commuter train station in downtown San Francisco, he doesn't have any trouble imagining high-speed rail.
We have this golden opportunity in our little golden state.
Doty's an engineer with the California High-Speed Rail Authority. To him, the project's benefits are obvious.
Riding on that train right behind you right now is 30 times safer than driving that automobile right over here to the side. 30 times. And why we don't do everything we can in the United States to put people on rail is sort of crazy.
That's not how Pat Burt sees it. He's the mayor of Palo Alto, about 30 miles down the line from San Francisco. It's a college town, leafy streets, local businesses. When Burt stands at the city's downtown train station, he doesn't have any trouble imagining the train coming through. It's just that he doesn't like what he sees, a big, noisy eyesore.
This would be, in a worst-case scenario, an elevated structure. So the entire thing would be over 50 feet in the air, racing through the center of the city at 120 miles an hour with a train every few minutes.
Palo Alto is one of three cities south of San Francisco that are suing the state's rail authority to keep the train out. And they're right that it's hard to build a fast train through a densely populated area. At top speed, California's trains are supposed to go 220 miles an hour, And that's only possible in the rural middle of the state.
Obviously, the Central Valley is where California's system will be true high-speed rail. It's where it will hit the highest speeds.
Jeffrey Barker is a spokesman for the Rail Authority. The federal government gave them $4.3 billion to build the first segment of the line, but they can't build just anywhere. The Fed said they have to start in the Central Valley. Compared to the density of San Francisco and Los Angeles, it's the middle of nowhere. But Barker says that's not a bad thing.
It's where there will be entirely new infrastructure. And that's key in the near term, obviously, because it means a tremendous amount of job creation and work, you know, on the ground.
So the first segment will be the easiest to build, and it will let officials showcase what their train can do. But unless the state finds the money to build the other segments, it won't actually get anyone anywhere. Palo Alto Mayor Pat Burt says that proves the project is a waste of money.
If we were, as voters, promised a high-speed rail system, but instead we have a train system that goes back and forth between Fresno and Bakersfield, is that what we were promised?
Pat Burt's just one guy, but his skepticism, that's something a lot of people share. Republican wins in last week's elections are already calling the future of rail into question. California has a shot at proving how great the trains can be, but it's going to be a while. Jeffrey Barker of the High Speed Rail Authority says they're not even going to buy train cars until at least 2015, never mind run them.
It wouldn't be until about 2017 on this kind of hypothetical, optimistic timeline that we would actually run service.
With that kind of timeline, one of the project's biggest challenges is going to be keeping taxpayers motivated. Brian Stanky is executive director of Californians for High Speed Rail, an advocacy group.
The voters of California didn't say build a quarter of a project and make it the best quarter of a project you can. They voted to build the whole project. We need to plan to build the system out, not plan to build half a system and then stop.
Building the train is risky. If people think it's a waste of money, they won't want to give it more money, which means it will end up being a waste of money. Either way, that high-speed ride is still close to a decade away. In San Francisco, I'm Casey Miner for Marketplace.
Casey's piece and the rest of our series came to us from the public radio project Transportation Nation. As we said up at the beginning of the program, President Obama's not feeling any love at the G20 meeting over in South Korea. Everybody's griping about the Fed's latest round of money creation. And some of the loudest complaints are coming from the Chinese, which prompted this from commentator David Frum.
Nerds to them. China keeps its currency cheap so as to promote exports, especially to the United States, thus creating jobs for China's needy millions. How extreme is China's manipulation? Well, think of it this way. Since September 2008, the U.S. dollar has declined 30% against the currency of number one trade partner, Canada. Against number two, China, flat until this summer, then down only 5%. China deploys all kinds of administrative tricks to suppress the value of its currency and sustain exports. But these tricks come with a fearsome side effect. To keep level with the declining U.S. dollar, China ends up creating lots of excess Chinese money. That excess money bids up the price of assets inside China, especially real estate. In fact, we may be witnessing the biggest real estate bubble in the history of the world inflating before our eyes. The Financial Times reports that the typical apartment in Beijing or Shanghai sells for 15 times the typical income. Even at the peak of the U.S. housing bubble, our home price-to-income ratio was less than half of what China's is now. This bubble frightens the Chinese, as well it should. But China has a simple remedy available. They could quit printing so much excess money of their own and allow their currency to appreciate. Or they could make the opposite choice, keep their currency artificially cheap, borrow jobs from the rest of the world, and brace for a great real estate crash sooner or later. Their call. But what they are calling for now is for Americans to rescue them from their own self-generated problem. They want the United States to run a tighter monetary policy and accept more unemployment to spare China the need to make any hard choices. And they won't even offer cooperation on Iranian nukes to sweeten the deal. Why would any American say yes to that one-sided proposition?
David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum. Back in the day, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Coming up next Wednesday, Robert Reich is back. In the meanwhile, we hope to hear from you. Get in touch online. Marketplace.org is our website. The link you need says contact. Coming up, Wendy's starts flavoring its fries with sea salt. Can't you just taste the hype?
I see Triscuits and Wheaties and Cheetos and everything using good salt someday in the future.
But first, there's this thing we got to do. The Dow Industrials bumped up 10 points today, nearly a 10%, closed at 11,357. The NASDAQ up 15.6%, 2578 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 5 points. 0.4%, finished at 12.18. Crude oil pumped up to nearly $88 a barrel, rose more than a buck today after an Energy Department report showed a surprising decline in inventories. ConocoPhillips and Chevron each gushed up almost 2% today. Citigroup and Bank of America each climbed about 2.5%. Boeing nosedived 3% after those engine troubles we told you about earlier. Campbell's Soup spilled 3.3% today after lowering its yearly forecast. Bad is about all you can say to that one. Dean Foods continued to drop after yesterday's sour quarterly earnings. The country's largest producer of milk curdled by 10% today, lost 18% yesterday. Bond prices rose on this Wednesday. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Reputation Defender, introducing tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and small business owners protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling a business's reputation online at ReputationDefender.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. President Obama is scheduled to meet with Chinese President Hu Jintao ahead of the G20 meeting in Seoul, South Korea. Events at Arlington National Cemetery and around the country mark Veterans Day. And on November 11, 1993, the Vietnam Women's Memorial was dedicated in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
It's Wednesday, along about the second half of the broadcast, which means it's your turn. We were talking trash the other day, only in the best possible way, of course, about Hefty marketing a new line of black kitchen garbage bags. Jessie LeClaire was listening that day from Kyoto, Japan, where, she notes, the local government issues clear trash bags.
So it's very embarrassing for me because sometimes I don't exactly know what should be thrown away and what shouldn't be thrown away, and I'm always worried that people will see through my trash bags.
Susanna McCune of Suquamish, Washington, only uses recycled bags, she says, that are more biodegradable, so the color changes depending on what those bags are made out of.
The color of the bag means that I'm taking steps to try to minimize my impact on the environment and to try to ensure that what goes into the landfill gets to break down in the most expedient, safest way possible.
This week brought the new web browser RockMelt to us, designed, or so the marketing campaign went, to try to make it easier to use social networking applications. We were reminded by some of you that we forgot to mention one thing. There already is a social-centric browser out there. It's called Flock, and it's been around since May of last year. Moving on now, Stephen Breton of Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida, didn't much care for my interview last Friday with Haitian author Edwige Dadika. It was part of our Art of Money series, if you remember. At the top of the show, he wrote, you said this was one of the most economically news-filled weeks ever. So why did you spend time interviewing an author about Haitian art? The story, he said, belonged on a different public radio show. Dab Bishleen wrote from Juneau, Alaska, though, with another point of view.
As the father of an adopted daughter from Port-au-Prince who visits Haiti often, any recognition of the struggle facing the proud people of Haiti is greatly appreciated.
If you have thoughts about what we cover or how we cover it, send them our way. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. This is going to sound like it's coming a little bit out of left field, but if you haven't been keeping an eye on the Irish bond market lately, you might want to start. Borrowing costs there have been shooting up all week. Same kind of squeeze the Greeks got caught in earlier this year, right before that huge bailout, courtesy of the European Union. Not all that long ago, Ireland's economy was ripping right along. The Celtic Tiger, it was called. And then the housing market took a dive. Banks lost billions. Unemployment rose to almost 14%. And now tens of thousands of Irish are leaving the country and trying their luck overseas. And Marie McNerney reports.
A group of young Dubliners meet up for a few drinks and a chat in their local bar. It could be anywhere in Ireland on a Saturday night. But this isn't Ireland. It's Vancouver, Canada, one of the top destinations for the thousands of Irish emigrants who've recently had to quit the Emerald Isle. People like Derek Kavanagh, an electrician whose work dried up when Ireland's property bubble burst about 2 years ago.
The construction industry is pretty dormant at home, with no prospects getting a job. Like, any time you read a newspaper or look at the news, it's all about the failing economy and about job cuts, about tax increases, and it's great to be over here.
The prospect of a better lifestyle and new opportunities drew another victim of Ireland's construction implosion here, 30-year-old architect Aileen Igo.
There was always that kind of dagger hanging over your head that you could be out of work, you know, within the next couple of weeks.
It's estimated about 5,000 people a month are quitting Ireland. Those emigration levels haven't been seen since the 1980s.
During the 1980s, there was a lot of blue-collar or low-skilled emigration.
In Dublin, economist Jim Power of the Friends First Financial Services Group says there's a big difference between this latest exodus and the last one 20 years ago.
This time round, they're largely skilled workers, engineers, architects, a lot of people that were involved in the construction industry, which has collapsed, but also people in financial services have been forced to leave the country.
And they're not all from the private sector. Cuts in public spending have hit many people working in Ireland's publicly funded health service. The Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation says all of Ireland's nursing graduates will have to go abroad if they want full-time positions. 22-year-old Tadhg Gately has just qualified as a nurse. He's planning to move to London.
When I started the degree, it was one of the only jobs out there that you could be safe. It was always going to be sick people, so there's always going to be jobs, and it felt like it was a real safety net that I would be employed and I wouldn't have to face the prospect of unemployment.
But not all the emigrants are jobless. Deep cuts in public spending have blocked the prospects for many Irish workers to train or move up the career ladder. That's why physiotherapist Sarah Gannon quit Ireland for Canada.
Things have gotten very static. There's a sense at home that if you had a job, that you should have been, you know, happy to have a job and happy to stay in it. But really, that wasn't enough for me.
Traditionally, ambitious Irish emigrants have headed for the United States, but that's changing. Stephen McLarnon is the chief executive of WorkingAbroad.net, an organisation that links would-be emigrants with recruiters and visa experts from other countries.
The US has become a lot stricter on illegal immigrants coming in. Also, there's a greater awareness now of what visa opportunities there might be across Australia, New Zealand and Canada.
The influx of skilled Irish labour will bring immediate benefits to those countries, but the damage to Ireland could be long-lasting. In Dublin, I'm Anne-Marie McNerney for Marketplace.
We have, as you might imagine, a news meeting around here every morning, trying to figure out what the stories are that we're going to cover each day. There are breaking news spots and feature stories. And then there are the usual suspects that help round out the rundown. Random economic indicators, retail sales, and fast food, believe it or not. We could probably fill a spot on this show every day with news from the fast food universe, were we so inclined. And we are not so inclined. In fact, I'm happy to say I dodged a strong push from the meeting this morning to do something about Wendy's French fries. I mean, come on, French fries?
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Jennifer Collins. Yeah, live radio?
Yeah, I got that. But this French fry story is pretty good. Wendy's is going to be rolling out a new kind of fries tomorrow. They've got the skins on, and they're seasoned with sea salt.
Sea salt. Yeah, you came running into the studio, middle of the show, for sea salt?
Okay, yes. But have you watched a cooking show lately? Everyone seems to be talking about salt.
And then the last sensation you get is that little bit of sea salt with the chocolate sprinkles.
This is an exciting salt. It's actually called the fleur de sel.
And Maldon sea salt, and then the whipped cream they hand whip. Sounds bizarre, but it's not.
More than 1,000 new products with sea salt were introduced this year. Phil Lempert is a food marketing expert.
So what we're really seeing is a new salt phenomenon taking place, where we're even seeing people selling blocks of salt that you would grate yourself.
Like a Himalayan pink salt block for around $70. Lempert says sea salt's new status gives Wendy's a little more cachet.
In taste test after taste test, McDonald's is always coming out first when it comes to French fries. This is going to give Wendy's a point of difference, and if nothing else, get more people into the store to try the fries.
Lempert says sea salt is more natural and perceived as healthier than your basic table salt. Mark Bitterman is the author of Salted.
I see Triscuits and Wheaties and Cheetos and everything using good salt someday in the future.
Okay, Cheetos? How can Cheetos use good salt?
How do you make a gourmet salt Cheeto?
Bitterman suggests Moshio, a Japanese salt made with a 2,000-year-old technique. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform made some news this afternoon. That's the panel the president set up back in February to figure out a way to cut the red ink in the budget. Today, the two co-chairs of the commission, a Republican and a Democrat, released their draft report. Draft being the key word here. Congress is eventually going to have to approve any of this. But the draft does say we should look at getting rid of the home mortgage interest tax deduction. We should raise the gas tax and control how much Medicare is growing and get ready for some changes to Social Security. Eventually on those changes. The recommendation is to raise the regular Social Security retirement age to 68 in about the year 2050 and to the age of 69, wait for it now, in the year 2075. So if this program is still around then, we'll be sure to tell you about it. But for now, on this Wednesday, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 10 points, about a 0.1%. The NASDAQ up 15.6%. The S&P 500 gained 5.4%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, it's always best to be prepared in case you have to leave at a moment's notice.
It is as important as a will because you need to have a plan in place for your children.
Illegal immigrants and unexpected departures coming up tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.